first a good and welfare housekeeping. The next 2 weeks, the class will not meet. Class will not meet for the next 2 weeks. And we will meet again on what I think is January 9th. Okay? So, next week and the week after, there will be no Dhamma class. Again on January 9th. Now, we are on Daf Lamed Zayin Amud Bet. We'll just look back a tiny little bit at what we were concluding with last time. Lamed Zayin 37b. 37b. Even better than that, B3, if you're in the English. That's not a direct translation, B3. Okay. Now, you will have noticed, partly it's the result of the last Mishnah, the Ketzad Me'ayimim Et Ha'Edim. How is it that one induces a state of anxiety in the witnesses? That's out of the last Mishnah. We've been really flowing from there ever since. We have been reading some halacha, but it's really been mostly Agadah in response to that particular Mishnah. Partly it's the content of the Mishnah. It's about the uniqueness of every human being. So that lends itself to Agadah. But you will see now that from this point on until the end of the chapter, it's all Agadah. And frankly, for those of you who have been in the Talmud class for many years, I don't know that we have seen that in a very, very long time. And that's for basically one stylistic reason. And that is that you will find in the chapters of the Talmud that it is not at all unusual that as you get toward the end of the chapter, you will get a lot of Agadah. It's just often the way the text is edited, it will have some relation, of course, to the halakha of the text, but it will be principally Agadah or entirely Agadah. The reason that we don't see it all that much is that usually in this class we begin at the beginning of a chapter and we never get to the end. So we really just never get a chance to feel that piece of the editing. It just so happens that the fourth chapter, we're going to make it to the end.
All right? Because
we skipped the middle. Well, we did the very beginning, did the Mishnah, and we skipped around. We're second year in the Masechet, not the second year in the chapter. Last year we began the first chapter, and we did the beginning of that. Right? We didn't get to the end. So it's not that we've never done this. We have done it. We've gotten to the ends of chapters. We did it Bat Rachel. We went all the way through every chapter. We did the whole Masechet. So we've seen these things before. And that's not to say that Agadah will not appear elsewhere. Agadah will appear just woven into halachic text. You'll read halacha, you'll get 10 lines of Agadah, and then you'll go back to halacha. That's not at all infrequent. But when you find this straight Agadah, that's very, it's not always at the end of a chapter, but it's not unusual at the end of a chapter. And that's what we're going to see here. Now keep in mind, also in terms of the methodology of reading Agadah, since we haven't read that much, haven't had a lot of opportunity to talk about how you read Agadah. And realize that that itself has been a very controversial subject throughout Jewish history. There are many places, for example, many yeshiva to this day that simply will not read Agadah. It is considered to be a waste of time. The only thing that counts is the halacha, the legal portions of the Talmud. And the Haggadah is considered to be fanciful, children's stuff. And therefore, you know, the He-Men don't read it, as it were. Well, even if you look at, for example, Maimonides has a great deal on the subject of Haggadah. Maimonides has a different approach to it. Maimonides' approach to Haggadah is that Haggadah has to be read allegorically. Allegorically. That everything in the Talmud is there for meaning. And that if you are going to read an Haggadah, you have to figure out what its allegorical meaning is. Its allegorical meaning. It may not be a meaning that you can immediately sense, but it's there for some ulterior purpose. And therefore, as a matter of fact, Maimonides wrote that he had a plan. After he had finished the Mishneh Torah, he was going to do something similar with the Haggadah. And part of his plan was going to be that he was going to explain the allegory behind the Haggadot. Everyone being assumed, therefore, to have some allegorical meaning behind it. I'm very sympathetic with that position, but I would go even further. As a modern reader, I would say that the phenomenon of Haggadah really has to be understood in several different ways. Firstly, I'd just like to go back to the conceptual framework, which was the conceptual framework introduced by the late Max Kedushin in his book, The Rabbinic Mind. The Rabbinic Mind. What Kedushin said was that essentially the rabbinic system is not a philosophical system, but a system that sort of moves toward something that is like philosophy. That is one of the reasons that the Haggadah has always been rejected, even by philosophers. That Haggadah tends to be stories. Not always, but it frequently is stories. It's not readily understandable what the meaning of the stories or of the allusions is. And therefore, philosophers tend to dismiss the Haggadah unless they take the view of Maimonides that we just got to figure out how to break the code. Kedushin said the following. Kedushin said that the rabbinic system is really not a classical philosophical system. Simply it doesn't speak in categories that philosophy speaks in. But rather it is a system of concepts. But not concepts as you find concepts in philosophy, but rather what he calls value concepts. Value concepts. There is in the rabbinic world a wide complex of values. And when you read the text, you realize that it is operating in a value system. Kedushin used to say, he was very dramatic about this when he would make his point. He would say, Aristotle is cold, very cold. You could freeze when you read Aristotle. And he would say, the Talmud is warm, very warm. Now, to go beyond that a little bit, there is a difference between warm and cold. And in a lot of 19th and 20th century writing about both philosophy and religion, one of the things that has gone on is the movement between the poles of warm and cold. To some extent, there have been those who are only interested in the cold. They're interested in abstraction. They're interested in history. They're interested in abstract concepts, in ideas. And then there is the more touchy-feely approach, the approach that is interested more in experience. And as you well know, experience is very difficult to articulate. It's particularly very warm experience. It is difficult to articulate in abstract words or abstract sentences. It tends to push itself toward myth, and that is one of the reasons why those who have moved away from the abstract and toward the warm have frequently been very interested in mysticism. Because mysticism is not at all philosophical, tends to speak in mythic language, in story language, and is dealing with more emotions than ideas. Okay? More emotions than ideas. Kedushin felt that the rabbinic system was somewhere right in the middle between the both. And that it wasn't cold and it wasn't warm. And therefore, it didn't really have myth the way the Zohar did. The way a book that is filled with endless stories and endless fantasies is filled. Nor did it have philosophy the way philosophers expected a book of philosophy. He therefore termed the rabbis as dealing in what he calls value concepts. Concepts in that they are somewhat abstract. You can talk about them. Values in that they tend to come from the gut inside. They tend to be rich in emotion. What is a value concept? Well, something, we have words for the value concepts. For example, there is something, we have a word, for example, called chesed. Chesed.
Mitzvot are the values.
No, wait, don't get mixed up. There are a million kinds of mitzvot. All right, there is a value system. We'll get there in a minute. But take something like chesed. Now, I don't know how you translate chesed. I mean, I've been in this business a while, and I couldn't translate chesed. I have a way that I translate it these days, but that's because of what I've learned from my professor of Christian ethics, Paul Ramsey. I translate chesed as love. Love. You go into a prayer book and you won't see it translated as love. Generally it's translated in the American prayer books as always loving kindness. Or kindness. Something like that.
Compassion.
You can have, compassion may work in certain circumstances. There immediately you see the problem. The problem is that you really can't translate the Hebrew words. You cannot translate. What can you do with it? There are two things that you can do with it. This is the nature of value concepts. Value concepts go in two different directions. They are concretized in two different ways. One way is in halakha. The other way is in agadah. And therefore, in order to get some sense of the scope of the value concept, we will go toward halacha and we will go toward agadah. Now, I'll give you an example. Chesed drives toward the halacha of gemilut chasadim. There are specific activities which are called gemilut chasadim, the rendering of acts of chesed. Okay? So, visiting the sick, for example, is halacha. It's a mitzvah. Okay? But it is the concretization of the value concept of chesed. Okay? We may have a story about some rabbi who goes and visits another rabbi. And, for example, a Masechet Brachot tells the story of one rabbi visits another rabbi. The rabbi is very sick. And he sticks, the rabbi who's visiting him, the sick man says, give me your hand. He says, why do you want my hand? He says, why do you ask me for the hand? He says, because a sick person cannot lift himself up from where he is. Now, that's an interesting point. You always need somebody else's hand to lift you. Okay? That doesn't mean physically. It means spiritually. It means from the state of being in your own consciousness the ill person. You really need frequently, not always, but you need somebody to lift you out of there. There's a need for another person. Alright? That kind of a story. That's an agada. We had a halakha and we had an agada, both of which are manifestations, are concretizations of the notion of chesed. Thankfully, to the extent that this is a valid idea that Kedushin is articulating here, and I think it is, there is a whole vocabulary, a Hebrew vocabulary. It is a Hebrew vocabulary. It can exist in no other language. You can't translate it. Because it all depends upon the way in which the language is used. And there is a Hebrew vocabulary. There is a Hebrew vocabulary of value concepts. Okay? Now, I give you this background because we're going to be reading a lot of Agadah. We'll be reading a lot of Agadah. And you will see that when I will read Agadah, I will almost go the Maimonidean route, which is to say, what is the nature of the symbolic language here? Is this an allegory? What is it saying beyond the words? What's the point of the story? And we're educated as people who have modern secular educations always to say, what is the point of a particular story? Okay? My own sense will be to go in that direction, not to allegorize it too much, though. Not to allegorize it too much, to allow it to sort of move itself. Because once you enter the world of allegory, realize that allegory is also a problem in religion. Let's give you the classic example. Classic example of the problem of allegory in Judaism is not Judaism, but Christianity. Christianity reads the same text we do, and they say, well, when it says here that there shall be a woman who will give birth, oh, well, we know what that means. That's called Christmas. Okay? When I read that, I don't necessarily see Christmas in it. But that is all allegory. Okay, that's allegory. Everything that's in the Old Testament can see what the allegorical meaning is, and we bring a different context to it. So, you have readers like myself, as a student of Kedushin's, we don't like to move too far from the text. But we understand that Agadah is not just play, that stories are there for more than entertainment, although some are there for entertainment, there's no doubt, but that they have a point. And in all likelihood, their points are very closely connected to the text. But it's a challenge always as we read through the Agadah to try and articulate what those points are, giving ourselves a little bit of creative freedom, not too much creative freedom so that we don't end up in Christmas. Yes, ma'am.
Which gave birth to which halakha versus agadah?
Yeah, he says impossible to know.
It's impossible
to know. Because he says it's just the nature of the phenomenon that some things tend to go more easily in the Agadah direction, some things go more readily into the Halakha direction. Yes, he does have patterns in them because each one is by itself and you have to look at each one on its own terms. So there are patterns, yes. Yeah.
So is it fair to say that the Talmud was written, codified, okay, as a way for the people to survive the foreign land, foreign environment, by taking our values, our basic Jewish values, and constructing a way of life around them?
I would say yes and no. I don't want to say that the purpose of the Talmud was to create a vehicle to make sure that Jewish values were protected in an alien environment. That I think is going a little too far. Because as far as I can see, this notion of halacha and agada and what's in the Talmud doesn't really have anything necessarily to do with an alien environment. It is its own culture. This is the culture of the Jews. You know, different cultures articulate values in different ways. You could look at any culture and try to use that perspective to come to understand the culture. It is true that in this Talmudic culture, the Talmud does very much that. And it becomes extraordinarily important. And for that reason, I think it's still, to my mind, the most important vehicle for the preservation and the teaching of the continuity of this value system. That's Talmud is crucial for that. Because once you get into Talmud, you end up willy-nilly. You find yourself wondering where is all this going? And it will go either to halacha or it will go to agadah. And you become then either a more halachic person or a more agadic person or a combination of the two. And that's because you've been living with this kind of literature. The literature has that effect. I mean, if you, for example, learn everything from American television, let's say. You ever go on television? You ever watch television? Once in a while I get sick and I watch the television.
You get sick and you watch television or you watch television and then...
It's a combination of the two. You know, if you want to know a little bit of something about our culture, there's a lot more complexity to the horrendous things that happen to us, unfortunately, that we're living, you know, right in the middle of right now. Gun control is an important piece of this thing. There's a lot more to it than that. There's a lot more to it. You look at the violence. I don't know about you, but I can't even watch movies anymore. And I've seen a lot in my life. And I wonder what it is for 11-year-olds, 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds, 15-year-olds to watch this kind of stuff in the movies. I don't know what kind of a culture this is. It's a lunatic culture. And that I can see that immediately. And then everybody's saying, sure, we don't know what's going on.
Not well in the video games.
You probably know, you know, each of us has a perspective on this. And we've got kids and we've had inputs, and we see these crazy things that the kids are exposed to. Thank the Lord I wasn't exposed to that when I was a kid. God knows what I would have ended up as. So that's, you know, just one little piece of a much more complicated problem.
But, punch that guy in the nose.
What?
He told us to punch that guy in the nose.
Right. Yeah, that was good. Well, I can also say publicly, I'm in a way delighted. Not delighted, it's a horrendous thing we're going through. But it would be very good if we make some progress. Very good. And I'm so skeptical in my stage of the game here and it's not just the NRA. It's everybody else in the country, too. Everybody is messed up. That's what drives me crazy. I don't know about any of you, but I grew up shooting a cap gun. Did you get shoot cap gun? We always played cowboys and Indians. Okay, Annie, you know, when you came Hanukkah, what would you get? You get a new gun. Well, as far as I know, I'm not a gun crazy nut. It was a very different world where you could, in fact, be kids who would shoot guns at each other, but nobody would ever imagine that it was for real. That this is what it was to play fantasy. This is what it was to be a little boy. Boys had aggression, and they learned, you know, they had ways of dealing with aggression. And that's also part of the picture. There are things that boys do that are potentially really big problems. Most of these violent things come from boys. It's not, hopefully not yet a woman's problem, but it's, hopefully it'll never be a woman's problem. Yeah, but she didn't shoot anybody. She didn't kill anybody.
You know,
women, But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the difficulties of young male violence. And I'm not making any comments on this except to say that this is a really big issue where we come from. Namely, in this society, we're kind of living with this right now. And it's I just hope we make some progress, because it's a lot of bad stuff going on there. Not one thing, not five things. There are 25 bad things that are really, really bad and are just gone amok. And it's not all the psychiatrist's fault either. Today I was listening on the radio, and we need more psychiatrists. Well, I think we have many psychiatrists in this blessed congregation, and I know how difficult it was for them to make a living when suddenly all the sources of income were taken away from the psychiatrists. You know, because we don't need them. You know, we don't need any psychiatrists. We got a lot of problems. But, so, if you look at the TV and you look in the movies, you have value systems. Right? You go to a movie. A movie conveys values. Conveys values. That's the purpose of literature. You read a book, where books convey values. Good novels teach you values. Right? And they don't, however, teach you halakha and agadah. Halakha and agadah is peculiar to this system, I think. The only other group I know that has a system that's quite similar to this is the Arabs, the Muslims. The Muslim system is not all that different. If you ever study Islam, you will see that the Sharia of the Islam, of the Muslims, is a system much like our halakha. It's much like our halakha. So at least in terms of structure, you can see a relation between Islam and Judaism. And of course, Islam comes much later. So they are a product of this earlier religion, which is ours. So now with all that introduction, let's go back into the text. Okay? 37b3. We were reading this Agadah last time. Now let's read it again and see what we can do with it. The Amar Rabbi Yehuda Berei de Rabbi Chiya. This is 37b3 on the left side. If you're not using that text, it's down about three quarters of the way down on the Talmud page. Amar Rabbi Yehuda Berei de Rabbi Chiya. Okay. Miyom shepatcha ha'aretz et piha. From the day that the earth opened its mouth. V'kibalto ledamo shel hevel. And received the blood of Abel. Shuv lo patcha. Shenemar miknas ha'aretz zmirot shamanu tzvi latzadik. This is a quote now from Isaiah, and it says, "Miknaf ha'aretz, from the edge of the earth, we heard songs, praise for the righteous one, praise for the righteous one. Miknaf ha'aretz, from the edge of the earth, v'lo mipi ha'aretz, and not from the mouth of the earth." All right. What in the world is that saying? Okay. What in the world is it saying? Well, I'm not going to explain it yet. Let's go a little bit further. Okay. Eite dechizkia achiv. So, his brother, this rabbi's brother, is named Chizkia. His brother then raises an objection. He says to him, "But tiftach ha'aretz et piyach." What do you mean the earth never opens its mouth again? Of course it does. Korach. You remember the story of Korach?
No.
And what is the story? What happens in Korach? Vatiftach ha'aretz et piyach. The earth opened its mouth. Ah, so answers Rabbi Yehuda to Chizkia. L'ra'a patcha l'tova lo patcha. For something that's evil, it's ready to open its mouth. Not for something that's good, though. Okay. So, what is the good? What are we talking about good and evil here and the earth? Well, I think that what you have here, this is a beautiful agatha, where the earth itself is told that it is now going to suffer. Once the blood of Abel enters into the earth itself is no longer the same earth. It is the earth that has absorbed the blood of a murderer. Okay? And the commentators here, I think, are on point when they say that the purpose of the earth was to sing the praise of God. When it is lo padcha et piya, means it can no longer sing. The earth can no longer sing. The earth is no longer able to sing once it has taken in it the blood of murder. Okay? So in other words, here, it's interesting that the earth is no longer the same earth once it has dealt with the blood of murder. I would have thought, frankly, that nature is amoral. That is to say that the sphere of nature is outside the realm of morality. The earth doesn't care what happens in human life, I might have thought. Or the earth will not respond to it. But the purpose of the Agadah is to say that nothing is separate from morality. Very much along the lines, by the way, of the second paragraph of the Shema. V'hayayim shamoa tishma'uel mitzvotai. If you listen to my mitzvot and you do everything that happens, then the rain is going to fall. That is to say, nature is not separate from the moral realm. Nature and morality are not separate, even though our intuition would tell us that they are two separate areas. Okay? So here you have in this Agadah, in this effort of Rabbi Yehuda, the son of Rabbi Kriya, to say that the two realms can't be separated. They really can't be separated. And in fact, the earth can no longer sing. It no longer knows how to sing. But there is a way to sing. And that is that it no longer comes from the mouth of the earth, but from the kanaf of the earth, the kanaf. And here the English translation is, from the edge of the earth we heard songs. It's a verse now from the book of Isaiah. So to say that the earth still has to sing its praises to God. It still is a divine creation. But it is impeded in its ability to do that because its mouth no longer functions the way it did. I would actually translate kanaf differently. Kanaf can mean, as it's translated here, it's a fair translation, because you say, you put the kanaf patil b'chelet, right? So it means, or you have arba kanfot, the four corners of a garment. So kanaf means a corner. What else does it mean? Oh, even more than that. The wings. And that's the way I would like to see it translated really here, is miknafa aris, the wings of the earth. The wings of the earth, they sing. They sing to God. So the earth, in other words, has its own wings. It has its own life. It's not just the edges of it, but it flies. It's able to fly, just as a bird is able to fly. And a bird, of course, sings. But a bird sings through its mouth. Here, the earth is like the fowl, able to sing through its wings. So I think that's my sense of it. Go over to the Tosafot on the right side of the page, toward the bottom. You'll see a fascinating... Here we just read an Agadah, dealing with song. And I want you to see that there's actually a halachic ramification to this. Miknaf ha'aretz zmirot shamanu. I'll do my translation. From the wing of the earth have we heard song. Katuv b'tshuvat ha-Gaonim. It is written in the tshuva of the Gaonim, the responsa of the Gaonim. The Gaonim now are your teachers, 9th, 10th centuries, Babylonian. She'en b'nei Eretz Yisrael omrim kedusha ela b'shabbat. That in Israel, in the land of Israel, the Jews who live in the land of Israel only recite the Kedusha on Shabbat. They only recite the Kedusha on Shabbat. Dichtiv, as it is written in the 6th chapter of Isaiah, Gabe Chayot, as far as the Chayot go, those are angels, a form of angels, Sheish Kenafayim Le'echat, each of the Chayot had 6 wings. Remember the vision of Isaiah. Each of the angels had 6 wings. The Chol Chanaf Hu Omer Shira. Beautiful. See, this is where the Agadah gets its meaning from. Each of the wings would pronounce a song. Each of the wings would sing a song. And when we read about in the prayer of the Chayot HaKodesh that sing to God, Kadosh, 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 that is coming from their 6 wings. That is coming...
Choir.
That's the choir, exactly. That's the choir. So, V'shesh Knafayim Le'echad, V'chol Kanaf Hu Omer Shira Achat, B'yom, B'yom, B'shesh Kimei Achol. Each one of the wings would say one song for each one of the days of the week. Okay, so each of the wings had a day on which it would make its song. Uchashehigia Shabbat, but when the Sabbath came, Omrim Chayot lifnei Makom, the Chayot said before the Holy One, Ribono shel Olam, ein lanu od kanaf. Lord of the world, we have no more wings. We have no more wings. The HaKadosh Baruch Hu meshiv lehem. Yes, all right. And the Holy One, blessed be He, would respond to them, Yesh li od kanaf echad. I have one more wing. Shomer lefanai shira, which says before me song. Sheneamar, as it says in the book of Isaiah, Miknaf ha'aretz nirot shamanu. That verse that we have just read now. From the wing of the earth do I hear the song. Okay? So when you read in the Sabbath, in the early part of the Sabbath prayers, about the Chayot HaKodesh and them singing, you also read on the Sabbath, you read El Adon. El Adon, which is the whole creation singing. It's the whole creation singing. And to my reading, that is straight out of this. This is straight out of, I don't know the history of it, but it is the same idea. It's the same idea. So here we've seen an Agadah. There's actually a potential halachic ramification of that Agadah, although it doesn't really have any practical value, because we say this every day, right? We say Kedusha. In fact, we do say Kedusha every day. So I guess we follow the Babylonian tradition. It'd be interesting to see whether there are any extant remnants of the tradition from the land of Israel, as apparently it's taught here by the Gaonim, where they only said Kedusha on the Shabbat. But we don't follow that tradition. But so you see, there's a halachic ramification for all of this, and ultimately, the Agadah is in a way teaching a philosophical concept that there isn't a separation between nature and the realm of God's will and morality, and there are practical halachic ramifications to it as well. That is the nature of this beast. Okay. Any questions or comments?
I was going to say, I do think I have seen paintings of angels, Christian paintings of angels with multiple wings. So I think, you know, I don't know whether it fits, but there are wings that have like rainbow colors, mm-hmm. and I think that there are angels that have more than that.
It'd be interesting to see where that, you know, this is a good area of iconography for an art historian to work in, because one of the things that I've noticed, even going to the Met now, is that the people writing very often the people writing the descriptions have not read the Bible. They have not read the Bible. Because I know immediately, I'm no art historian, but I know when I'm looking at something, bingo, I know what's going on there because the painters read the Bible.
I thought that we talk about different clothing.
Well, there are different, there are clothing, there are chayot, there are a variety of different kinds of angels, and they're not all the same. Exactly how they're different, I couldn't tell you, but...
Is there a category of importance between...
Oh, there's a whole literature on that. And the Merkava mysticism, those are crucial issues. But I can't say I'm an expert on that. Okay.
May I just add a word?
Yes, please.
So a Gaudic study in this realm, according to one of my teachers, Professor Rabbi Aryeh Cohen, it's always interesting to look when an Agada brings up names. It purposefully brings up, in this case, a father, and in this case, two sons, two twin brothers, according to our tradition, and one is rabbi, and one is not. And where the text does not include the title, and yet puts Torah in the mouth of a sibling within a family, is an important concept by way of the way we expressly expect Torah to be learned within the context of mishpacha, of family, within the Jewish people and community. And not only that, but other places, davka, about this family, they move from Babylonia, in the tradition, to Eretz Yisrael. They become stalwarts of Torah learning. And Chizkiah, mentioned many times throughout the Talmud, is the schoolmaster. They actually refer to him as in Beit Chizkiyahu, in his house of learning, from Tiberius. Tiberius, one of the forgotten, a more forgotten of the holy cities than the other ones coming out. And so where we notice that Torah extends from within the family is this a disagreement as well, and that the notion that we have civil disagreements and re-understandings and different readings right within a family is the extension, allegorically, if you will, mm-hmm. to the disagreements and the machloket and the differentiated kind of opinion that can exist when you're looking at, say, it's prophetic literature or, say, it's halachic norms. Mm-hmm. And this is one of these places where you only get a brief statement, if you will, but a lot of times it will go on where Chizkiyah is mentioned in a number of his teachings, both Agadic and Halachic, to right. make the point back to what you're saying about mm-hmm. Kedushin, mm-hmm. I think, which I hadn't put it in Kedushin's context before, that interplay is really alive and well, right within his own sense.
Very good.
Of
Very good. It goes on. Let's keep going on now.
Brought up in the context of Cain and Abel?
Oh, that's a good. That's good. Yeah, it could be.
I think that's
perfect. You got it. Very nice.
I think that's a very nice connection.
Very good. Very good. Yeah good. Shakach. Okay, very good. Let's keep going now. Diamar Rabbi Yehuda Vereda Rabbi Chia was still with the same Rabbi Yehuda. Galut mechaperet avon nechza. Exile atones for a sin by half. Neikara ketiv hayiti navanat. At first it is written, I was, remember last week I read you the New English translation, was a ceaseless wanderer. These are the words of Cain. And he then moves and says Ulevasov Kati Vayeshev Be'eretz Nod, and he settled in the land of Nod, of wanderers. Okay. Now, here, another Agadah, we're reading about Galut. Galut. Now, realize when you read about Galut, it should ring a bell. Because we live, of course, in the Galut. We're living outside of the land of Israel. It's not at all unusual that you will have comments on Galut, but Galut can mean many things. If a person has done wrong, there is a notion here that the way in which you atone for sin is through appropriate punishment. Okay? And there are certain types of punishments for certain sins. Galut is one of the sins, one of the punishments for sin. It is the classic archetype of punishment for sin of the people of Israel. Certainly throughout the book of Deuteronomy, that is the key point that is made, that if you do not abide by the commandments, if you do not live according to the way you have to live in the land of Israel, you will suffer galut. You will suffer galut. Because of our sins, we have been exiled from our land. Okay? Now, the notion here, just behind it, is that if you sin, there should be punishment for sin. Unless, of course, there would be forgiveness. It could be that there would be forgiveness of some kind. Some sins may be forgivable, other sins may be not forgivable or less forgivable than other things. But again, you have sin and a way of expiating the sin. Suffering is, in classic rabbinic theology, a way of expiating sin. And if you suffer, you've sinned, you suffer, and you can go beyond that. You can go beyond that. I'm not necessarily advocating this, but I'm explaining it. Okay? Now, here you have Rabbi Yehuda, the son of Rabbi Chiya, and these are Israelis. Okay? They're living in the land of Israel. Living in the north. Galut mechaperet avon nechsa. Galut is effective. Being exiled is effective. And in all truth, galut can mean galut to the next town. Because you have stories in the Talmud, for example, where people are sent into galut. Doesn't mean that the people of Israel go to Babylonia, necessarily. It means that somebody goes three towns away. You know, and he's forced to live in an alien environment where nobody knows him. And when you live in an alien environment, it's a purging experience. It can be very difficult. You don't have any friends. You don't have relationships. And all of that is part of the purgation, the experience of purgation that gets rid of sin. But let's look at this, though. It's only mechaperet avon nechsa. Gets rid of half of the sin. It's half of the sin. And here's an interesting source here. One half. Okay? And this source is a good source because it says about Cain, Hayiti Navanat. I was a ceaseless wanderer, but I would wander the Nad. Last time I told you that I understood this to mean Na, to be emotional, internal. Nad, to be external, going around from place to place. The reality is that there are two sides to this. One is the place, the other is the effect of the place on the person. So one is Na, and the other is Nad. Okay? So Cain ends up, the Torah says, he eventually dwells in the land of Nod. Vayeshev Be'eretz Nod. Nod is like Navanad. Navanad. So he dwells in the land of wandering. dwells in the land of wandering. And as, if you remember, I mentioned to you last week at the end of class, what does he do in the land of Nod? He founds a city. That is the key thing that he does, is found a city. And ultimately, in the land of wandering, the place of both security and alienation, the combination of the two, it is the city that is the place of anonymity, where people indeed never stop wandering, and yet it is the city that also is able to collect the wanderers from all over. That is the dynamic, the inner dynamic of the city. And that, of course, is founded by Cain, Cain, who is Navanav, and somewhat settles down, which is the reality of the city. Right? He somewhat settles down in the land of Nod. But just to finish, and then we'll get to you in a second, Barry, but keep in mind now that from Rabbi Yehuda, the son of Rabbi Chiya's perspective, the effectiveness of wandering is partial. It's partially effective. Keep this in mind, because the text is going to go on now, and you're going to see some difference of opinion about that. Yes?
I see this presaging the tension of manslaughter in the city of refuge. That in this first example, we have someone who is somewhere between a murderer and a manslaughterer, because mm-hmm. of the things that we talked right. about being the first event. We have the blood not boiling, but being swallowed so that there's no trace of it. So there's blood, and that sort of needs to be avenged, but in this case, it's sort of covered over.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this intermediate between murder and manslaughter. We have the mark, which is designed to protect him, and then he winds up in a city of refuge. And again, the tension between the heinousness of the crime and the need to avenge it, both at the earth level,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, recognizing the need for an understanding that there may be something in between that should not result in the need for a family member to avenge the crime itself.
Mm-hmm.
So I see a lot of what will continue to be this tension played out in this very first story.
I think it's a terrific way to read the Torah, because I think the Torah is best read as layer upon layer. It's really a layering kind of book, where you start out with the essential layer here and the stories that you read at the very beginning of the Torah, but you really can't understand what happens later on, even the book of Deuteronomy, without seeing it within this context. And it's a great way to see it.
So galut is a punishment, but what happens if the guy is doing quite well in the galut?
Oh, what are you going to see? I never heard of that Israelis should feel that way, but we'll see in just a second. Go.
Don't we know that a city in galut is not like living in your home community?
Mm-hmm.
The Jewish people have been in exile. Situation can't
plan. Most of them didn't want to come there?
Well, compared to, yeah, a few ways. But compared to living in the land of Israel, whatever the problems are, how often do we go? Where else could we go? This is where we are from. So it's a city of Hanoch.
Mm-hmm.
It was an illusion in a sense that he thought he had. I wanted to ask another question. The idea of sending as a punishment an individual for sin, galut, what in the next village over, there's another form of that which is fair. So there you are, a stranger to everybody, and you're still a hero.
Correct.
Where does that come from? It's better to send somebody to be away.
Yeah, no, that's... It's different. That's the same kind of idea. I understand what you're saying. Because if you read the Gemara in Masechet Moed Katan, Moed Katan deals with this. It deals with Cheren and Nidui, two types of putting a ban, a person in a ban. And there, in the third chapter of Moed Katan, you have, how can I say it, almost the phenomenological and psychological structure for a ban, and it's all creating alienation of the individual while still being in the community of people. So making
ostracism?
It's a form of ostracism, correct. And a person has to dress in a certain way. And a person cannot interact normally with other people. All of those things are creating separation. Even where there is no physical separation, it's creating real separation. So that's a later development, though. I mean, that's an atonement. A form, what's called in the Talmud, a ban. A person is put under a ban, and they are not allowed to participate in the community's life. Okay, they're put in cherem, as we say. They're put in cherem. Now keep in mind that cherem in the Bible means something else. It does not mean that in the Bible. It says a very different meaning in the Bible. In the Bible it means complete destruction.
Does that mean that when the practice of imposing a ban on an individual while he continues to reside there, it's eliminated, sending somebody away altogether?
In theory, I'm sure it wasn't practical at a certain point. But it didn't necessarily. I'm thinking the Talmud, for example, you have this notion of cherem. In Moed Katan, so it was something that was used. It was a method used by the court to sort of deal with recalcitrant individuals, and sometimes even with recalcitrant rabbis. Rabbis are put in cherem, and it's a rather strong thing to do, but it was done by the court. One of the things that it may have been there for was because other alternatives were not so practical. Among them, as we already said, the court had limited power. To ostracize. Social ostracization is in a community that's a live community is a very effective tool. Very effective tool. Not completely effective. We just went through this in Brooklyn, by the way. Just been through this in Brooklyn, where you had Rabbi Shafran, Rabbi Avi Shafran of the Aguda, in reacting to the conviction that was gotten of the sexual harassment case by Mr. Hines. One of the reactions in the Hasidic community was, you know, we can take care of this on our own. It's the same kind of thing. We should be able to socially ostracize because there are enough of the community. But of course, the reality is that it never would have happened. It never would have happened simply because women have no status in the community. And women really don't have the forum to pursue their case. So that's why the state, in fact, stepped in, and the state, in my opinion, wisely stepped in this case, even though I'm respectful of what, you know, there are other methods of achieving the end of punishing people. There are other methods. But in this case, they would never have worked, and therefore it was right for the state to step in. But these are in communities that are more traditional communities. Socially ostracizing a person can be very effective.
What was his chaffrin's
point? We could have handled this. We could have done this on our own.
Also the same thing.
Yeah, which I just thought that was a terrible thing for him to say. He shouldn't have said that.
Because he varied in these cases for decades.
Of course. And the problem is Hines, exactly. Hines was accused of burying them, and it seems that it was very much the case. But I can understand it if you're the district attorney in Brooklyn. These are your people that you're dealing with, and you've got leadership there, and also the leadership that these communities. The Rebbe says you vote for somebody, and they vote for them. They vote 100%. You know, approximately 100%. It goes whatever the Rebbe says. So it's a tough thing. But it was good that this came up, that finally it was forced. I think it was good that it was forced. Yeah. Very, very good. Finally, because that'll have an effect on those communities. You know, it shakes them up. And it says to them, you know, you've got to deal with these problems. If you don't want this to happen on a regular basis, you really have to handle it. And maybe they'll handle it, maybe they won't. it's not very hopeful, but a little hopeful.
Did you ever read the memoir of Raoul de Kolstad?
No, I never did.
He came to Amsterdam.
Or Uriah.
Oil the custom. It was put in hair. It's put in hair.
So it's like a form of torture he describes.
Yeah.
It's not saying the he prevented and then wound up the same conspiracy.
Now, hair and milk perpetual, or is it only for a period of time?
It depends. It depends. You can usually... The standard in the Talmud Shamta is for 30 days. But the court has a lot of leeway in these things. Okay? Generally, the court wants a person to repent. Usually, when you put someone into harem, when Spinoza was put into harem, I'm sure the idea of the court was, number one, to punish him, but number two, to get him to change his ways. And that was... But you can't go too far with this. Once I had a very strange experience. I was the last speaker in a long colloquium. It was a long colloquium on Spinoza. It was Spinoza's. This must have been 1975 or something like that, something around 1975. So that would make it the 300th anniversary of Spinoza's, either death or birth, something like that. So it was a controversial thing. The Department of Philosophy in the seminary decided to have a colloquium on Spinoza. Heschel refused to attend. I'm trying to think, this must have been 1971. This was before Heschel died. He refused to attend. He said, how could you ever have a colloquium in a religious institution like this for a heretic? He says, it's absolutely forbidden. So he never came. So Heschel didn't know. He was furious. Right. And so we had all these distinguished scholars from all over the world came to talk about Spinoza. Well, it's a long colloquium. Came to the end of the day, and I was the last person on the way, because I was the lowest member of the faculty. I was low man on the totem pole, and they were nice, they gave me something for change to say. So I was a little bit crazy, and I was did things that I wouldn't do anymore. So it must have been 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and all the scholars were really fast asleep. Everybody was fast asleep. So I figured that I would wake them up. So I read, I said, I just want to give you a reading, not of Spinoza, but of Maimonides. So I read Maimonides' Laws of Cherem. about the reasons that you can put people into cherem, just to put this into context. And all I will say to you, without telling you what Maimonides says, is that there are a lot of strange things you could be put into cherem for. What finally woke the scholars up was when I read that an erection at the wrong time could be deemed by... Suddenly everybody was awake. So I was daring in those days. I did strange things like that. So I wouldn't go too far with the ramifications of this. I think that some of it is quite questionable. Okay, now let's go on. Now, here we have another case. Amar Rabbi Yehuda. Now, this is Rabbi Yehuda, not Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda. It's Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda was a first-generation Amorah. First-generation Amorah. Studied first in the land of Israel and then went to Babylonia. Was the founder of Yeshiva of Pumbedita in Babylonia. Okay, that was Rabbi Yehuda. So this is first in his, he's the teacher here. Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Galut Mechaperet Shlosha Bevarim. Right? Galut, being sent into exile, can atones for three things. Right? Shneamar. Hayoshev ba'ir, Shneamar, Hayoshev ba'ir azot, Yamut b'cherev u'b'ra'av u'b'defer. Okay? Three kinds of things shall die by the sword, by hunger, or by pestilence. By Yotzei v'nafal, ala kastim, atzarim aleichem, b'chaya. But whoever departs and it falls within the custom of besiegers shall live, by atal lo l'nafsho v'shalo, and his life shall be to him for a prize. So there are three things. The details are, to me, unimportant here, because I want to get to the next one. Three things for which Galut is Mechaper. And these are things that are serious. They're serious. They could be penalties that could be penalties of a capital court. Next is, secondly, Rabbi Yochanan. Now, Rabbi Yochanan was a contemporary of this. He was a contemporary, but Rabbi Yochanan was in the land of Israel. He was in the land of Israel. So Rabbi Yehuda had gone from the land of Israel to Babylonia. Where was he living? He was living in the Galut. He was living in the Galut. Okay? Rabbi Yochanan says, Galut mechaperet al hakol. For everything. Galut is an atonement for everything. And then he has a verse, Shenema ko amar shem kidvu at the ish hazeh ariri, gever lo yitzlach mi amav, ki lo yitzlach mi zaro ish yoshev al kisei David Moshe el od Yehuda, uvatar de gala ketiv, uvnei yechonia asir shel tiel beno. This is the story of the exile, Babylonian exile. Reference is made to that here. Yechoniah is told before the exile that he will never have any children. We know from the book of Chronicles that after he was exiled, he has children. It's not exactly clear how many. So, obviously, it made a difference. He was in exile. And the fact that he couldn't have children is ultimately the worst thing that could happen. According to Rabbi Yochanan, Galut is mechater talakol on everything. Now I would just put these two together. Here you have Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says even though it's significant Galut, it has only the ability to get rid of three problems. Now, my reading of that is Rabbi Yehuda is saying, you know, Galut is not so bad, along the lines of what you were saying before, right? he basically chose for himself to be a rabbi in the Galut. He was a rabbi in Babylonia. Okay? So, yeah, you're right. The Talmud says, I agree, Galut is mechaperet. It does atone for things. But we all know Galut is not a better. Rabbi Yochanan, on the other hand, says, Galut mechaperet al hakol. In other words, Galut is so bad. Here he's the Israeli rabbi saying that, that the level of punishment is, the self-punishment that you would go through then is able to atone for any sin. Okay? So there too, I think the two of them are contrasted, one with the other, and in a way, you know, their lifestyle is reflected. Where they are is really reflected in these two different points of view. Okay, any comments there? Yes.
I have one question about what we should learn from this Agadah about the earth. Is it that we learn that there are some things, as you say, that have no, they cannot be, there's no redemption. The earth did something that became stained, and that's it forever. It can never sin. Or is it consistent with this
It doesn't go anywhere. I mean, it just leaves you with no ability to sing there. So in a way, the second part, if you find a way out of it, is crucial. You have to find, the earth has got to find a way to sink. I would agree.
Have the notion in Talmudic Judaism that there are sins for which there is no, there's punishment and no way to atone for it?
Yes, we do have that. Even though it's assumed that Jews don't believe that, we do have those ideas. You can find them in Maimonides at the end of Hilchot Tshuva, Laws of Repentance, because he says these are the things for which you cannot repent, for which repentance is ineffective. And then we also have a notion in the Talmud of hell and purgatory. Which we're not supposed to have. Jews are not supposed to have that idea, but it's in the Talmud. so we do have that idea.
Because here we're learning about capital offenses, and we can forget about the fact that it was never imposed, but the death is meant to be in it.
You're correct. That's in a capital offense. But there, you can see in Maimonides, Maimonides says that it's generally true, but it's not always true, because there are some things that you do that even your own death cannot atone for.
Even your own death cannot atone for.
Right.
So that's why you're talking about Sheol and purgatory, because even after death, continued punishment?
Correct.
There are offenses for which you are punished into the seventh generation.
You can see it in terms of the generations, and that's in the Bible. And then it can go even beyond that. It's still with us. It's an interesting question.
Isn't there a distinction between atonement and tshuva? I mean, can't a person always perform tshuva, even if you can't be forgiven, even if you can't be redeemed, even if you can't atone for what you did? You still have the responsibility and the ability always, up until you die, to perform tshuva.
Correct.
And the point is that's what Judaism is based on, is the option, the choice, the free choice that you have to perform tshuva, and that's always there,
well,
until you die.
Without that's true. That is true. Yes.
Can it be a capital case that the judges will change it to galut?
No.
So why it says yamut b'cherev when you say yishev v'ir hazot yamut b'cherev?
Well, I think one of the things to keep in mind here is that galut functions where, in fact, the court cannot do what we think it should be doing. Remember that. The court didn't necessarily have the power to do what it was supposed to do. So it has to have a variety of... That's why I think harem becomes a major concern eventually in rabbinic times. We don't have it in the Bible. Because in the Bible you have a functioning system where in fact the punishment can be administered. Okay? So I think that's another strand that you have to keep in mind when you read these things.
Well, that's a weakness of the court system that, you know, if you will...
Right. It's a weakness, but what are you going to do? The Romans are the ones who are controlling it. You know, that's... The problem is more than just the courts not wanting to do it. The courts are not permitted to do it because someone else has sovereignty in the land of Israel. That's called Rome. Right? Then you got limited options. Limited options.
One thing about in Russia, his offense is so serious that if he had been in Israel, he would not have been on the
beat. Uh-huh.
So is his, I'm just curious, is his sin of excluding himself, of really not seeing poor, something which one cannot be redeem oneself?
I wouldn't go too far with that. It makes a good story at the Seder. But I wouldn't want to push it philosophically too far. But not the Christmas. Okay. Now let's just do one more. I want to go one more just because I think that in case you are worried about us dealing with stuff that was too heavy, I want you to see where the Agadah can really sort of lighten your life. So they're trying to figure out the names of whether Yechoniah had one son or two sons, or whether it was one son who was called by two different names. One of the names that we have here is Asir. And Asir literally means a prisoner. Right? Asir she'ibrato imo bevet ha'asurim. His mother, he was called Asir because his mother conceived him when Yechoniah was in prison. The Babylonians had thrown him into prison, so his mother conceived him when he was in prison. Shealtiel shetalo el shelo kederach shenishtalim. So he had another name, which was Shealtiel, and that was because God implanted him in his mother in an odd way, lo kederech hanishtalim, not the way most people are implanted. So what are we talking about here? Okay. You'll see it's not exactly the Christmas story. Gemiri she'ena isham mitaberet milmad. We have a tradition that women cannot conceive if they have intercourse with their husbands when they're standing up. That's why I wanted you to read this. It's very... I want you to go home without this information. Okay. Now, Yishan Mitaberet is probably logical. I mean, it's the law of gravity in a way. I want you to see the rich... This is what the Talmud tells you. So we have a tradition. She'ein Yishan Mitaberet Milmat. Right, we learn that a woman cannot become pregnant if she has intercourse standing up. Vehi nit abra mi'umad. And Shealtiel's mother conceived him when she was standing up. Right, that is the issue. The question there, do you remember that it says that he was called Asir because he was in prison. He was in Rashi says he was in a very tight spot. He could only stand up. She had visiting rights. He came. And that's why, and Shealtiel is because he was Shatul al Pagemayim. Somebody is implanted. Somebody implanted. Shatul is implanted. So he was implanted standing up, very weird, right, when she came to visit him. Okay.
And we're not psychologists to have this kid reminded every time I said his name.
I shouldn't remind the kid of that.
Come over here a little standing up.
Well, with that I want to wish you a very happy and a healthy 2013. and we will see each other on June, January 9th. January 9th.
Can I ask you one more question? The duality between the Agadah and the Halakha, and the one with the touchy-feely and the...